Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. Dr. Maulana Karenga is professor and chair of Africana Studies at California State University, Long Beach. He holds two PhDs, his first in political science with focus on the theory and practice of nationalism, and his second in social ethics with a focus on the classical African ethics of ancient Egypt. An activist scholar of national and international recognition, Dr. Karenga has had a far-reaching effect on Black intellectual and political culture since the 1960s. He has played a vanguard role in shaping the Black arts movement, Black studies, the Black power movement, the Black student union movement, Afrocentricity, and the study of ancient Egyptian culture as an essential part of Black studies. Dr. Karenga is the author of numerous scholarly articles and books, including Mott, The Moral Ideal in Ancient Egypt, A Study in Classical African Ethics, Selections from the Husia, Sacred Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, and Odu Ifa, The Ethical Teachings. He is currently writing a book which is titled The Liberation Ethics of Malcolm X, Critical Consciousness, Moral Grounding, and Transformative Struggle. Dr. Karenga is also widely recognized as the creator of Kwanzaa, an African-American and Pan-African holiday celebrated throughout the world. He is the author of the authoritative book on the subject, Kwanzaa, A Celebration of Family, Community, and Culture. Dr. Karenga, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm very glad to be here. And I look forward to an excellent exchange.
Oh, I look forward to it as well. Now, you know, you've received many awards for your life's work, too numerous to mention in an introduction, but suffice it to say they include words like pioneer and living legend, apt descriptions, and creating Kwanzaa, as we know it, is down in the fourth paragraph of your bio. So when we look at the joys, challenges and events of life, including our political events and struggles and happenings, we view them through the lens of a spiritual journey. In that light, would you please share with our listeners how Kwanzaa came into being? And please take your time. You have the floor.
Mashukai, I created Kwanzaa in the context of the Black freedom movement, the struggle for Black people to expand the realm of freedom in this country, and to engage in dignity-affirming, life-enhancing, and world-preserving ways of our ancestors. So as Amilcar Cabral said, part of the struggle, at the center of the struggle, is a struggle to return to our own history, to define ourselves, to name ourselves, to celebrate ourselves, and to speak for ourselves. And that, by the way, is a second principle of Kwanzaa. So I created Kwanzaa for three basic reasons. Number one, to reaffirm our rootedness in African culture, because we had been lifted out of our own culture by the Holocaust of enslavement and made a footnote and forgotten casualty in other people's history. So again, as Cabral said, the struggle, the liberation struggle itself was in fact a struggle to return to our own history so we could, as we say in Kawita, speak our own special culture truth and make our own unique contribution to the forward flow of human history. Second, I created Kwanzaa in order to give us a time when we could sit down, come together, and reaffirm the bonds between us as African people. When African people all over the world could come together, be of one accord, and meditate on the awesome meaning of being African in the world. And now, as you know, Kwanzaa is a world-encompassing holiday celebrated in African communities all over the world, throughout the world, African community, on every continent in the world. And one major part of that is January 1st. In fact, Kwanzaa is a seven-day holiday that begins 26 December and goes to 1st of January. And so on that last day, January the 1st, is called Siku ya Tamule, which means the day of meditation. And there we're supposed to sit down and meditate on the awesome meaning of being African in the world. What is the responsibility of being from the fathers and mothers of human civilization? What does it mean to be the descendants of the Holocaust of enslavement, sons and daughters of the Holocaust of enslavement? And what does it mean to be the authors and heirs of this massive reaffirmation of ourselves in the 60s, this reaffirmation of our social justice tradition and our Africanness? And we do that by asking and answering three basic questions. Who am I? Am I really who I am? And am I all I ought to be? And these are ethically and spiritually grounded questions, which we can get into in a minute. But I want to continue with why I created the holiday. And the third reason I created the holiday is in order to introduce and reaffirm the importance, the ethical and spiritual importance of African communitarian values, values that stress and strengthen family and community and give us an expansive conception of who we are, past what we call degraded forms of individualism and thinking about ourselves as in relationship always. We say, I'm related and relate, therefore I am, as opposed to I think, therefore I am, because we come into being in relationship. Before we're born, we're in relationship, and every relationship requires responsibility. And when we have this larger conception of ourselves, what we call a cosmic conception of ourselves in African tradition, Emily Wengu is the word in Swahili, citizen or inhabitant of the world. When we have this, then we're responsible not only for our families, our friends, not only for the well-being of our family and community, but also the well-being of the world. And that's about the health and wholeness of the world. That means all humans, animals, plants, and all other living beings and inanimate things, the waters, the earth itself, and the air above. And that is what we call the world-encompassing conception that Kwanzaa at its heart and at its best represents. So it's those three reasons. And the last reason, that communitarian values, of course, the hub and hinge on which the holiday turns, and the central communitarian values are the Nguzo Saba, the seven principles of Kwanzaa, one for each day, okay? And they are first in Swahili and then in English, umoja, unity, kujichagulia, self-determination, ujima, collective work and responsibility, ujamaa, cooperative economic, mia, purpose, kuumba, creativity, and imani, faith.
Thank you so much. It's so fascinating to think of, you know, that you've created a holiday. We've got generations, you know, who see Kwanzaa on a postage stamp and don't realize that it's a much more recent event and celebration. And I want to ask you, because it was established around 1966, as you said, in the midst of the Black Freedom Movement, was there resistance to Kwanzaa? I'd like to ask you that. Was it a struggle, as you mentioned, you used the phrase transformative struggle, which really resonates with me. Was this also a transformative struggle?
Not so much resistance, because we didn't impose it. And we didn't have the capacity to make people do it. But there was a good exchange. It became not only an institution that housed and advanced our aspirations as a people, but it became a ground for a kind of fraternal and sororal exchange about what it meant to be African, what it meant to celebrate ourselves in the most dignity-affirming and life-enhancing ways. And so at first it started, and I always give my organization credit. My name of my organization is US. US means US African people. And when we started, they were the first people to accept it and to practice it and to promote it on a larger scale, especially nationally and internationally. But then also the nationalist community, the Black Power community, if you will, but especially the nationalist community within that Black Power movement, began to spread it also around the world. Mm-hmm. And those people are very much responsible for it also. African students and persons from throughout the world, African community, from the continent of Africa, from Asia, from South America, from North America, of course, and from Europe. They actually took back some of this. Like, for example, this year we got correspondence from and emails and pictures from people celebrating in South Africa, okay? Mm. Panama. We've gotten communication from Brazil, from Korea, from Japan, China, India, London, Berlin, Paris, different places where African, Mexico, Colombia, also. So wherever African people are, they celebrate this. And so this has been a good thing. And it has not been any coercion at all. It's just a conversation. In fact, one of the things that Kwanzaa prides itself on is being, number one, an act of freedom, an act of self-determination. That is to say, it was an act of self-determination to decide we would have that ourselves. We did not ask permission. We did not go to the legislature and ask for approval. We did not ask anyone, did they like this holiday? We declared it, practiced it, and then the media and others, seeing it, then they begin to discuss it. Mm. But we did not ask for anyone's approval. And it was an act of freedom also, in that it was an act against culture and imperialism of a dominant society, which is essentially, as you know, Eurocentric.
Right.
And Eurocentrism in its worst form. And there's some positive Eurocentric, that is to say, Eurocentric ideas where, you know, you prefer your own culture, but you don't do it at the expense of other cultures, okay? But the most negative Eurocentrism is that one based on the fundamental principle that all relevance and value are centered in Europe, and that all other peoples are marginal at best and irrelevant at worst.
Hmm.
We stay away from that, but we reaffirm, right, the beauty of our own tradition. And then we find common ground. You see, one of the things that makes Kwanzaa have the impact it has, even with people who are not African, right?
Right.
And people who see in it, because every great message, and we believe that Africa has a great message for the world, and we see Africa as our moral and spiritual idea the same way that other people see other cultures as their, maybe Israel, maybe Arabia, maybe India, okay? They see their culture as a center of their moral and spiritual idea. But we see Africa at that, okay? And so what we then do is ask ourselves, what is the core, what are the core values of Africa? Those are particular, but because they speak to the best of not only what it means to be African, but also what it means to be human, other people see value in them. And that's with every religion, that's of a major impact, and that's with every social philosophy or cultural practice and cultural values that people also see value. This gives me a chance to stress the importance, because people always ask me, can other people practice Kwanzaa? Yeah, well, they can practice Kwanzaa. People can practice what they want. So a lot of times, families have different members in them. So, you know, I mean, that's really a question that can be answered, you know, like if you look at it rightfully, any human can practice any other thing that's going on that humans are doing. The question, do they want to, and then how they do it. If other people are going to practice Kwanzaa, it's very important that they not only say that they accept the values, but they remember the history, and they celebrate it in honor of the people and the culture for which it was created. And second, they show deference to the African people by always conceding that Africans should officiate that and be at the center of their own history and culture.
Mm.
If we move to the margin of our own celebration, what's the use of the celebration?
Right.
Because nothing else.
Right. No, thank you for that. Because I was thinking earlier when you were sharing about the values that they are such human values and the best of human values. But this is very specific. You're speaking in terms of what you've called the elders of humanity. You're talking about the ancestors. So when you use the word memory, like you just did, family and memory, which is very important, you're reaching back with Kwanzaa to this very ancient memory and value system, and bringing forth the celebration of for example, first fruits and you know, African traditions of this kind. Can you share some about the ethics that you mentioned? Because I've heard you say ethics is basically spirituality in action, and you have focused so much on ethics in your life, particularly the ethics of ancient Egypt. I would like if you could please touch on that and share what some of those ethics are.
Yes. One of the things that we notice is that every major issue that confronts us today has an ethical aspect to it. Whether we talk about environmental ethics, biomedical ethics, business methods, ethics, computer ethics, political ethics, you name a major issue, and it involves an ethical aspect to it. So what I did, I went back to school to get a second doctorate in the 90s in order to discuss things in an ethical form, to teach it in my university classes, and to engage the modern issues from an ancient ethical tradition called Ma'at. Ma'at is ancient Egyptian. And now, the ancient Egyptians have the honor and the distinction of having the oldest spiritual and social texts we have in the world. And for years, people so demonized Egypt that we could not study it. We saw it just as a land of oppression. But actually, it is the source of some of our most important concepts. For example, that humans are in the image of the divine. It's only 2140 in the Hosea, the sacred text of ancient Egypt. In the book of Keti, it says, humans are in the image of the divine and come from this very person, okay? And that there are certain things we should not do to ourselves nor allow to be done to us for fear of violating that certain status. There's a narrative in the book of Jeti in which Jeti goes to the court of the Pharaoh, and he tells the Pharaoh he can neither kill nor experiment on even a nameless prisoner, because even that nameless prisoner is a bearer of this special status called dignity. Shepesu is that. And dignity of the human dignity has three characteristics for him. It is first transcendent, beyond all social and biological attributes. One of the most beautiful things about this narrative is that it's the narrative chooses a nameless prisoner to indicate the value and sacredness of human life, so that we know that this prisoner has done something that has caused the prisoner to be set to the side, to be imprisoned, right? But
yeah.
Jeti tells the Pharaoh that this prisoner has the same dignity, inherent worthiness, as the Pharaoh himself. So that is the first quality, is that it is beyond all social, biological attributes. In other words, transcendent. Second is equal in all. And third, it's inalienable. You don't lose it because you lose a status. You don't lose it or have it taken away from you by a legislator, by a ruler or a king or anything. It's there. And that's, I can't imagine us making a human rights argument without making that original argument the Africans in the ancient Nile Valley civilization came up with in their discussions about what it means to be human. Mm. Okay? That's a beautiful thing if you just look at that and how it is. So, in 94, I decided to go back, and I said, I'm going to collect these texts, and I'm going to translate them from the original. I'm going to put them in a sacred text, because there's no unified sacred text in ancient Egypt before this. I'm going to do what ancient Muslim scholars, ancient Hindu scholars, ancient Jewish scholars, ancient Christian and Buddhist scholars, ancient Mayan scholars. I'm going to take this, collect these books, and I'm going to give them a name and put them in an order. And that's what I did with the Hosea. That began with my dissertation for my doctorate, 800 pages. Mm. And then it continued with the project, the Hussitic project, or the project on the Hussia, in which I gave myself 20 years to do it. I started this in 84, and I said I would do it in 20 years, by 2004. I have not finished. My new date is 2015.
Oh, wow. Well, that's definitely an act of hope there. I really appreciate that, you know, for those of us who write out there, the authors out there, you do have time, you know. We live in this instant society where we're supposed to publish our ebooks yesterday. And I think it's wonderful that you've devoted this kind of time to doing such a thorough scholarly work that needs to be done, that hasn't been done. As you were sharing there about, you know, the viewpoint of humanity and what it means to be human and the equal and what you were just saying, you know, it just brought to mind, you know, Jesus says in scripture about his miracles, all these things I do, you can do.
Yes.
And, you know, it's funny, the scriptures we don't really focus on very much out there in the institutional church. It makes you wonder, right?
Yes. And that is why people, like, move from organized religion to spirituality. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was impressed with how you talked about spirituality and ethics as opposed to a particular religion, because that opens the conversation for a deeper and more multicultural concept. Because our fundamental position about multiculturalism is that each people and each culture is a unique and equally valid and valuable way of being human in the world. That comes from our concept of shebesu, of dignity, the inherent worthiness of every person and people. And so again, I repeat, each person and people is a unique and equally valid and valuable way of being human in the world. And they have a special method. And that's real multiculturalism. Mm. If we start with that. First, the mutual respect for each people and culture. Second, mutual respect for each people, right and responsibility to speak their own special culture truth and to make their own unique contribution to the forward flow of human history. Third, mutual commitment to the constant search for common ground in the midst of our diversity. So let's appreciate our diversity, but also let's find common ground constantly, because if we do either one and don't do the other, we are diminished by it. Mm. If we try to do common ground, we erase ourselves without doing diversity, without holding on to our diversity. But if we just hold on to our diversity and don't do common ground, we destroy the basis for the kind of exalting exchange that humans in mutual respect and mutual appreciation can actually engage in.
Yes, thank you for that. That resonates so much with me, because in terms of the work we do here, it's not about just finding the common ground and expressing it the same way. We have common values, and you mentioned many. I mean, common values that we strive for. We can stray from, but we strive for, as you mentioned, the, you know, relatedness, the groundedness, the time together, you know, family and community and those values. We have very common values that way, but we express them very differently around the world. And how we express them is so beautiful and vibrant and colorful that, you know, it is very important for us to raise them up and not try to wash them away into some sort of an inauthentic kind of unity. It's not how we were created. You know, there's much more joy in it than doing that.
In my intellectual development, I have benefited tremendously from reading and studying the various cultures of the world. Certainly you imposed this conversation on me from the beginning. But then I began to read, of course, Africa, I read Asia, Native America, Latin American culture. So this, like, enriched my own understanding of my culture and found common ground in it. The fourth aspect of multiculturalism, I want to just say, is mutual commitment to an ethics of sharing and a shared responsibility for building the world we all want and deserve to live in. Mm. And that ethics of sharing, and I think this is one of the most important ways we can approach. I tell my class each semester, you know, I want you to think about a world in which there is this mutual commitment, mutual respect for each people and culture, mutual respect for each people's right and responsibility to speak their own special culture truth, to make their own unique contribution to the forward flow of human history, and mutual commitment to it, this constant search for common ground. And then this commitment, mutual commitment to an ethics of sharing. I told them that Tell me one thing that's a great value that doesn't need to be shared for it to be real. I tell them, look at friendship, the great things we hold dear, friendship, brotherhood, sisterhood, family, marriage, freedom, justice. We can't just have one people having justice, one people having freedom. That's diminishing the very concept we must share. And I talk to them about thinking about in this ethics of sharing, which I developed within the context of my philosophy called Kawida. Kawida is an ongoing synthesis of the best of African thought and practice in constant exchange with the world. I started developing it in the 60s, and I continue to do it. But then I tell them about this ethics of sharing. Number one, shared status. No inferior or superior person. Again, we're back to Shepesu, right? Second, shared knowledge, okay? People have a right to knowledge, to know. The ancient Egyptians, again, saw this as an ethical position. And they named human beings reki, which means wise and knowing beings. And that tells you not only how important knowledge is to defining ourselves, but also to developing ourselves so that, as Garvey said, we come into the fullness of ourselves. Without knowledge, we can't come into the fullness of ourselves. We don't know our possibility. We can't develop our sense of agency. Okay?
Right.
Third, shared space. We have to share our neighborhoods. We have to share this country and stop picnicking on immigrants. You know, we got to share the world, the environment itself. We got to share in those three fundamental bases in terms of space. And then we talk about shared wealth, shared power, shared interest, and shared responsibility for building the world we all want and deserve to live in. And each one of those, there's a long conversation, but I just wanted to list them, and then we could move on.
No, well, that's great because, as you've said, knowledge can't be knowledge just for its own sake. It needs
that's
to be
right.
shared, and that's what we do here and what
that's
we're committed to here.
That's right, and I appreciate that and respect you for that and wish you the best for that because without knowledge, I mean, we have a problem. You know, we have a problem of knowing each other, understanding each other, appreciating each other. You know, we walk in, I don't want to say it, ignorance, but unawareness, if you can.
In
a debilitating unawareness.
Yes, and then, of course, we limit our potential so much as human beings and as friends and guides to each other. Believe it or not, we're about halfway through the program. It's gone very quickly. Dr. Karenga, we're just going to take a very short break. Please stay on the line.
Please.
You are listening to the Godspeed Institute, a program dedicated to religious tolerance and spiritually based living. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Maulana Karenga, professor and chair of Africana Studies at Cal State Long Beach. Here's another voice from the 1960s, Dionne Warwick, with her latest song from this year, Love is Still the Answer. Stay with us.
Not so long ago, I would have told you that the world was round, good and sound, freedom bound, the future was secure. Now I'm not so sure, it seems like gravity has been reversed, and getting worse, nothing works and everybody hurts. Yes, there's a trail of tears down through the years of broken hearts. It's still so hard to let the sunshine in. Love's the answer. No matter what, love is, it's still the answer, just like it always was. Such a simple truth, love never changes or betrays a friend. From the start, love was part of some fantastic plan, some brotherhood of man. Now it's up to us, we the shine, the light of darkness rules. Our children lose. We're free to choose our fate, to find our way beyond this veil of tears. The sky is clear and every star stands for a heart to let the sun shine in. Love's the answer, no matter what. I swear love is, it's still the answer, just like it always was.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Dr. Maulana Karenga, Professor and Chair of Africana Studies at Cal State University Long Beach, and the creator of the holiday Kwanzaa. Now, there's so much to discuss, Doctor, about this, and you know, since Kwanzaa's been celebrated for decades now, and I'm sure it has developed and increased in meaning in your own life and sustained you and provided joy for many around the world. But I'd like to ask you, culturally, so much has changed for the African Americans during these decades, not the least of which is a black president and his family in the White House. But what has not changed? What has not been fulfilled in this struggle? Can you share some of that?
Yeah. Well, appreciating what you said, if I understand correctly, I try not to pose questions in either pathological or a non-achievement way. I like to talk about possibilities. Within our ethical tradition, one of the things we stress most is the need of the people for a sense of possibility, because they've been taught a catechism of impossibility. They need to be able to see themselves as capable of creating progress in history, of speaking their own special culture truth and making their own community, unique contribution to how the society and world are reconceived and reconstructed. So what we have before us is challenges, and these are human challenges and problematic challenges. A lot of times people think black people have problems. It's actually America that has problems, because social conditions create social consciousness. And right. You tell me where you live, I tell you where people are thinking. So like if you talk about black people doing commercialism, that's straight out of capitalism. That's corporate consumerism, cultivated with a passion and with trillions of dollars, so that we cannot talk about people outside of their larger context and their tendencies in society, racism, capitalism, sexism, and other isms that narrow the consciousness of human beings and therefore limits their conduct that would in fact lead them, as we say, to the fullness of themselves. Mm-hmm. So we have a black president, to speak directly to what you said, but that doesn't change the life of the daily life of people, of African people. If you think of King, he is calling America to account for itself, to actually do what it said, even if it doesn't do more. Malcolm called for it to do more. Malcolm X, right? Right. Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, okay? Oh, let's go all the way back to Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. Read right. their speeches. Listen to their right. challenge to America to live up to its highest value and even to go beyond. Where is that conversation now? Do we challenge America, or do we pretend that isolated incident and these are just crazies doing this? It's the same thing with Newtown, Connecticut.
Yeah.
We can talk about gun control, but what about the culture of violence at home and abroad?
I think a lot of it is fear. It's there's a lot of fear in terms of not questioning. I tend to look at things a little differently. I tend to look at the nation the way a parent might look at their child. I want to know all the good things going on. I also want to know all the bad things going on. And I consider that, you know, patriotic. I consider that being a good parent.
You're saying it is the way you look at it. I want to respond to it.
I say it to me, when I consider the country, I consider it the way a parent might consider their child. I want, you know, in terms of full well-being, of course I want to know all the good things my kid's doing at school and good grades and whatnot. I also want to know the shadow side. I want to know my child's problems. I want to know what they're doing that they shouldn't be doing so they can be the best child, or that this nation could be the best nation.
There you go.
So I consider that being patriotic. I don't think it's unpatriotic to question these things. I think it's like being a good parent.
It is. It is. And see, we must ask not whether or not somebody's crazy and isolated. We know we got to deal with mental health. We know we got to deal with limiting how many clips are in a gun and how to control guns, period. But we've got to ask, how can we improve society? How can we create a just and good society? You see, so I think it's very important for us to have a self-interrogation, a self-questioning. We call it, and in my, I issue every year a founder's message. And my message, this a founder's annual Kwanzaa message. And the title of my message this year is Kwanzaa, Us and the Well-Being of the World, A Courageous Questioning. And I talk about three kinds of questions that we have to engage in. First, a personal question. Who am I? Am I really who I am? And am I all ought to be? But that is always socially and culturally based. Then second, a questioning of society. And finally, a questioning about the injured world. Mm-hmm. How we are plundering and polluting and depleting the resources and denying a future to generations that come after us. How do we do that? And that's where the ancient Egyptian concept, Seruj Ta, which is all-encompassing, is so important. Because what it does is talk about those three circles where we need to heal, repair, renew the world, restore it, and make it more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited. That's an ethical obligation, and it means to raise up what is in ruins, to repair what is damaged, to replenish what is depleted, to rejoin what is severed, to set right what is wrong, to strengthen what is weakened, and to make flourish that which is insecure and undeveloped.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. Karenga. And it's interesting because we started the conversation talking about relationship and the divine, and then we see what happens when we become disconnected from that. So your annual questioning of who am I in this relationship is extremely pertinent. And of course, you know, leading up to the day of meditation, January 1st, in Kwanzaa. Now, let's talk, since we're talking about culture a bit, let's talk about a little bit about the media. Because it's very important to me as well, the images in the media, how images impact people, different forms of entertainment, like, for example, when it comes to images of the divine, we go from, you know, in our culture back from, you know, from Charlton Heston, from the Old Testament, we go to, you know, to Morgan Freeman. And frankly, if I died and went to heaven and ran into Morgan Freeman, I'd feel very comforted. No doubt. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, also about black presence in the media and in entertainment, because I know you teach about this as well, and it's important to you. You have a quote here. You say, "We committed to continuing and reinforced efforts to reduce and eliminate negative media approaches to and portrayals of black life and culture, and to organize a sustained and effective support for positive black models, messages, and works." Could you share a little bit about your passion around this regard?
Yes, and that's something. I participated and helped organize the Media Man March, Day of Absence, Mississippi. It was the greatest collective march in U.S. history. And over 2 million people were there. And one of the things I thought was important is doing just that, that what we have to do is recognize the society's power to define reality and to make others accept it even when it's to their disadvantage. You know, this is a very important thing. I teach my classes that one of the greatest powers in the world is the power to define reality and make others accept it, even when it's to their disadvantage. So if you can define history as only what Europe has done, if you can define God as white, if you can define God just as male, then you have an advantage over everybody else. And what is happening in the Eurocentric world, then those definitions always favor European people. And the beauty of the 60s was we challenged that. And Kwanzaa's in the midst of that challenge. Somebody having only this history. But our history goes back further. We stood up first, spoke the first human truth, and introduced some of the basic disciplines of human knowledge in the Nile Valley. And people from around the world came to learn that. Jew, Gentile, Hittite, Hyksos, Roman, Greek, Persian, Libyan, they all came, right? And they called Egypt the light of the world, the navel of the world, the temple of the world. And so what we need to do is have a discussion that involves Native Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, as well as Euro-Americans. We have to have, and you know, there are thousands of cultures within each of these we're talking. We're just talking about overarching cultural frameworks that we have this dialogue. And in the media, we have to reinforce our efforts to reduce and eliminate negative media approaches and portrayals of black life and culture, because it's a pathological portrayal. You know, and if you always see yourself in a pathological, deformed, and distorted way, you begin to think like that. And it's hard to then, in the midst of all this, to have a dignity-affirming, life-enhancing practice to advance yourself and to come into the fullness of yourself. I think it's very important we have to work for positive models, positive messages and work, and to achieve adequate and dignified representation of black in various media and in various positions in these media.
Can you share some examples, perhaps, of what you might consider positive role models or positive expressions of, in the media or entertainment?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure because, right to my mind, be honest with you.
Your mind, yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying, if we're talking about right now, I'd have to put so many qualifications on it that it looked like I said the opposite of what I'm saying. Give me somebody and you and let me respond to it, because okay. I don't see it yet.
For example, rap is negative. Is that true?
No. Actually, rap came in, and this is very important, and this is something else that the dominant society does. It makes us think in uncritical ways, and it makes us also think in generational gap ways. They'll tell us that our people are past and they're no longer relevant, but they will bring their old people on stage for honors, and they will have celebration for them at the Kennedy. So I think it's very important for us not to do that. Rap was a very important initiative. It came at a time when we were doing what is called crossover, when people like Michael and Prince were actually turning their back on blackness as blackness and saying they needed to appeal to a larger audience. So they were actually undermining the beauty and quality of black music, which is at the heart of anything called American music, right? So what rap did was came back and reinforced the black aspect of our music and celebrated the particularistic aspect of it. And then you had what we call teacher rap or educational rap. It came in Public Enemy, X-Clan, KRS-One. People like this that used to teach, use rap as a teaching. But the corporate world took it over and stressed gangster rap. And that we have to attack, because it represents America infusing itself in its worst forms in black music. And so you have, sexism, you have self-degradation, you have so many negative things in there, okay? So what I want us to do is to have those people that are doing good rap advertise more. Most of those people, many of them, I shouldn't say more, many of those people are selling their discs out of their trunk or in small settings, right? We got beautiful artists that do beautiful writing, but they can't get published. We got people that write excellent histories, but unless you write a compromise history, you don't get it. Europeans have chosen one group from the 60s. I don't even need to mention it. And if you don't write about them, you don't even know about the 60s. You don't know what's happening in the 60s. If I said, name two groups, three groups, and from the 60s, you most likely would name one group. And I'm saying that we have to stop that. So we need a broader consciousness of what we're trying to do. That's what I'm saying. And that's about everything. And the media does not help. It wants short things. It gives seconds for news. You know that.
Yes.
They don't want to talk about anything. Except now, they'll choose a subject, and they'll force us to watch it every day, all day. But they never choose a subject that is Native American, African, Latino, or Asian.
That's very interesting. And I, you know, as far as like the world of faith or religion goes, mostly the mainstream media encourage controversy and fighting. And that's one of the reasons that we, you know, began this program, because it's one of the only places I know of where people can chat for an hour and actually be heard and engage in conversation. And we're not encouraging the fighting and the divisions.
And
who's right and who's wrong, and everything gets stymied once we're in that mindset of just who's right and who's wrong, or who came first, or who has authority or who doesn't have authority. All the talk about religion or faith, it just stumbles completely. This is why we're here and devoted to talking at length with our neighbors. And as we're coming toward the end of the program, I'd like to return to Kwanzaa now, based on all the things that we've shared and touched on, because the values of the celebration help, as you say, to ground us again in our rootedness and to connect us again with the divine in these things. So we have a 7-day celebration, and on the seventh day is the day of meditation. And this is beginning tomorrow in terms of this particular year. Are the 7 days the same days every year? Is the holiday always falling on the same days?
Yes, it's always on the same date, December the 26th to January the 1st, always on the same 7 days,
and
December the 26th to January 1st.
And as you say, I love this quote I found of yours: any particular message that is good for a particular people, if it is human in its content and ethical in its grounding, speaks not to just that people, it speaks to the world.
Yes. Thank you very much. That's so. And I just want, I know we're to the end, but I want to just stress again the importance of Kwanzaa as a season of celebrating, embracing, and reaffirming the good in the world, the good of the world, and the good for the world. It begins as an ancient African celebration of the good harvest, the gathering and sharing of good in the world. And it becomes a model for us to follow, to cultivate good, to share good in the world. In its most expansive form, as the ancestors said, Kwanzaa is a joyful and grateful celebration of all that heaven gives, the earth produces, and the waters bring forth from their depth. Thus, the vision and principles and practices of Kwanzaa are rooted in and reflective of this quest for and commitment to good in the world, the good of family, community, and culture, the good of flower, forest, fruit, tree, and field, the good of life and all living things, the good of nature in all its infinite and variety and various beauty and bountifulness.
And all God's children say amen.
Okay, and Hotep Ashe Hedi.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Dr. Kwanzaa, as we come to the end of the program, I just want to let listeners know that all your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today and wish you a very blessed and meaningful and beautiful Kwanzaa this year and always.
And the same to you. Hedizat Kwanzaa. Happy Kwanzaa. And may the good we struggle for come into its own. And may everyone be blessed with the life that they deserve, because we all deserve a dignity-affirming, life-enhancing, and world-preserving way of life for us and for generations to come.
Maulana Kwanzaa. Now, before we end today's program, I'd like to share a tip with you for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. It is also the Christmas season, which runs 12 days to January 6th. And I'd like to share something from the Saint's Guide to Relationships. This is an entry called Footsteps, Trump Tower. And it goes like this. Christmas Eve, Manhattan, 1988. I emerge from the apartment of a colleague hosting a holiday party with a Charles Dickens theme. After reading from a Christmas carol and imbibing a hot holiday punch, I step outside onto a snowy, silent street on the east side, a street where I can still see the remnants of the bygone Victorian era in the architecture, especially tonight, a quiet, carless night. I pull up my wool collar around my neck and begin my walk toward the Fifth Avenue train station. On one of the street corners, a grocery store is still open, with a display of Christmas bouquets outside in the falling snow. There are red roses, pink, white, all wrapped for Christmas, with evergreen and holiday ribbon. I buy the white roses and continue toward the train. Along the way are some of the most affluent properties in the city, perhaps the world. Still in my mid-20s, I don't have very much. I have no life partner or child or country getaway, but I do have a sweet apartment, a good job, and loving friends. And so I feel rich and grateful in the way that city girls do, with my whole life ahead of me, sparkling in the new snow. I cross Madison Avenue, still heading west, and begin the walk alongside Trump Tower. On the Madison Avenue side of the building is something wonderful, a huge glass atrium with a bamboo garden inside, an excellent place to take a break, to have lunch, or to meet a friend. Tonight it is open, a shelter to the homeless. As I walk, I look through the tremendous glass windows and see all kinds of people resting on the benches, having something to eat, clinging together on Christmas Eve. I see four homeless people, one woman and three men, sitting around a table playing cards among deli cups of coffee and old stained parkas. The woman is in her late 40s, brown hair streaked with gray. I'm walking past the entrance door, and I slow down. I turn around and open the door. Entering the garden, I walk to the woman. Gently, I hand her my bouquet of roses and say, "Merry Christmas." She takes them and stares at the ivory velvet blossoms, speechless. Finally, a gentleman friend speaks for her, putting down his cards. "You couldn't have given them to a nicer girl." And we smile. And so the anonymous woman helps me to understand that the gift of finding the white rose is to give it away, not to hold it, striving instead to become the rose itself. And there is no better place to give away the sacred than Metropolis, a place where strangers cross barriers and boundaries each day, stepping out of life and character to greet each other on alternative, merciful, and sometimes exalted planes of existence. Thank you for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This program was produced by Michael Hallenbeck, and I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.